Nice place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. Have you ever been someplace like that? I've heard some people say that if they've traveled overseas, maybe on a business trip or maybe on vacation. Particularly, I've heard that regarding some areas in the Caribbean islands, where if you get off of the resort and you actually see where some of the folks live and you see the abject poverty that many of the residents there deal with, they will say those words, nice place to visit, wouldn't want to live there. Now, I've never been really overseas anywhere that I could say that about, but for me it was true for Washington, D.C. For about 3 years, I lived about an hour away from the nation's capital, and I took every chance that I could. If I had family or friends come to visit, we would always take a day and go to D.C., and I even had a little map lined out that we would start here and hit these particular places and be able to make it back in time to head home, because you didn't want to be there when the sun went down. Washington, D.C., in spite of its many monuments and everything about it, at least at that time, it topped all American cities for murders and violent crimes. It was a nice place to visit, but you don't want to live there. I mention this because we are about to begin a study of the book of 1 Peter. And this brief letter was written to Christians who were facing hostility and animosity from those around them. Now, one of the main themes of this book is hope. Not wishful thinking, but an unshakable confidence that God will fulfill the promises of His Word that haven't been fulfilled yet. We might think of biblical hope as future faith, or the certainty of what will be. Now, in the very beginning of this letter, we're introduced to both the author and the audience. And as was the custom in the first century, if you were to see a letter written today, at the beginning you would see who it's written to. It might say dear and a name. Then you go to the bottom of the letter, at the very end of the letter, you have the signature of who wrote it. But it wasn't that way in the first century. In the first century, you actually began with who wrote the letter. Then is identified whom the letter was written to. And so in the very opening verses, we read that Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, is the author. Now we know who this is. This is Simon Peter, the fisherman with a big mouth and an even bigger heart. Yes, it's true. He said and did some foolish things during the life of Jesus. But our Lord saw something in him that probably not too many people of his day saw, and frankly, a lot of people have missed down through the centuries. I'm convinced that Jesus would not have placed so much emphasis, so much time, and frankly, so much responsibility on someone who was the buffoon that often Simon Peter is made out to be. I think Jesus saw in him something very genuine. He saw in Simon something very real that he could build into. And he took that impetuous, impulsive person and transformed him into Peter the Rock. That's who's writing this letter. Now, it is the audience to whom Peter writes that ties into my introduction. This letter is addressed to God's elect, strangers in the world, scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. Now, this is very different from the letters of Paul. You go through the New Testament, and Paul wrote a number of letters. He will usually address it to the saints at Ephesus, the saints at Colossae or Corinth or Thessalonica, these different places. But Peter uses three concepts that graphically portray the people to whom he was writing, and I think we can apply to ourselves as Christians. First, he says that we are selected. In verse 1, he calls his readers God's elect. Then you go down to verse 2, who have been chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father, through the sanctifying work of the Spirit, for obedience to Jesus Christ by the sprinkling by His blood. Now, when you hear those words, I'm sure that that brings to mind the age-old debate of predestination and free will. I love a story that Chuck Swindoll tells of a gathering where it's split into two camps, and you had the predestination crowd on one side, you had the free will crowd on the other. And one poor soul couldn't make up his mind where he should go. So he slipped into the ranks of the predestination crowd. They challenged him, why did he come there? And he replied, I came of my own free will. To which they said, you can't be part of us. You must have been chosen to be part of our group. And so he retreated to the opposite group, and they challenged him the same way. Why are you here? And he said, well, I was sent. To which they said, you can't be a part of us. You must come of your own free will. It just underlies how silly that argument can be. Now, I'm not going to try to solve that argument this morning, like I could if I wanted to. It is true that the Scriptures use words like foreknowledge that Peter uses here. Paul uses the word predestined in the letter to the Romans. You see the word elect or election many times throughout the Old and New Testaments. But I will never believe, as some to the extreme of the predestination crowd would say, that God chose some to be saved and He chose some to be damned to hell. I don't believe that. Not as long as verses like 2 Peter 3:9, God is not willing that any should perish. Or 1 Timothy 2:4, God who wants all men to be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth. Long as that's in the Bible, I'm not going to buy that. Perhaps the Believer's Bible commentary says it best. Any difficulty in reconciling God's election and human responsibility lies in man's mind, not God's. The Bible teaches both doctrines, and we should believe both. The truth lies in both extremes, not somewhere between them. So I think rather than thinking in terms of either or, maybe we should approach this issue of predestination and free will as both and. Even John MacArthur, who's a staunch defender of predestination, admits divine sovereignty does not negate human responsibility. So when Peter writes here that these are selected by God, these are God's elect, he's not saying that somehow these are God's pets, that they're His favorites, that He shows favoritism to them against others. The Bible is clear that God does not show favoritism. But it does show that God loved us enough to make it possible for the way of salvation to be open to us. He selected the way in which people can be saved, and then He gave us the choice as to whether we're going to accept it. And Peter is writing to these believers, encouraging them that yes, God loves you so much, God cares about you so much, that He chose you and gave you the opportunity to choose Him. And that is a wonderful, comforting truth that we can all appropriate in our lives. Despite the difficulties that they were facing, despite the difficulties we face today, Peter's readers could be rest assured in the fact that they belonged to God and that He cared for them. Now, the second concept that he mentions is that they were scattered. Peter says that they were scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. I'll bet none of those words mean much of anything to you. The only one that might is Asia, and it's not the Oriental Asia that we think of. In the Roman world, Asia meant Asia Minor, which was a Roman province in what we now know of as Turkey. In fact, these five place names that he mentions are in northern Turkey. You say, okay, what does that mean to us today? The idea is that Peter is writing to people he himself had ministered to. These are people that he knew and they knew him. The church historian Eusebius tells us that after the apostles left Jerusalem and decided they were going to take Christ's great commission seriously, we're going to spread the word to the whole earth, they decided we're going to go in our different directions so that we're not overlapping each other's ministries. And Peter was given this area. This area of northern Turkey was the area that Peter evangelized. Now, we know from the book of Acts that Paul evangelized the southern part of Turkey. And at one point, very interestingly, in Acts 16, Paul wanted to go into Bithynia, but we're told that the Spirit of Jesus wouldn't let him do it. We're not told why at that point, just that he was forbidden to do so. Very likely, it's because Peter was already there. And rather than having them, their ministries run into each other, the Spirit moved him further west to a place that had not been evangelized at that time. So these are people that Peter had evangelized. These are people that Peter had ministered to, people that he knew, people that knew him. Now, some commentators believe that Peter's audience was comprised of Jewish converts to Christianity. You see, this word translated scattered, it's a Greek word diaspora, meaning dispersed. And it was a word often used of the Jews when they were driven from their homeland. They were dispersed through the nations. And so some take this word to mean that Peter's audience were Jewish. Jews who had come to Christ. But as you go through the book, you realize that Peter is talking to people who came out of a pagan background. These were not Orthodox Jews who had accepted their Messiah. These are Gentiles. These are people that have no knowledge prior of what God has done who have come to Christ. You're going to see throughout this book, and we'll point them out, you will see various allusions from the Old Testament that Peter applies to these believers. In chapter 2, he goes through a list of descriptions that he pulls right out of the Old Testament. You are a holy nation. You are a royal priesthood. You are all these things that God had called the nation Israel. Peter is now addressing them to these believers. Like Paul, Peter used a passage from the prophet Hosea in which he says, "Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, now you have received mercy." And he is again applying this to the believers of that time. And so we're not seeing, again, that Peter's just addressing Jews here. He is addressing believers, Christians. What he says in this book applies to us. Now, the problem with people being scattered is that it's easy for them to lose their identity. They may feel isolated and alone. They may be tempted, rather than to maintain their faithfulness to God, it'd be easier to fit in. And I'm sure each of us can relate to that at some time. It may have been in our younger years when we were in school, where it wasn't cool to be a Christian and to go to church. It's more cool to be in with the in crowd and do the things that they do. It may have been at our workplace where it's a lot easier to go along with the way they do things and the things they talk about and all of that than to stand up for Jesus Christ. Especially if we feel like we're the only one. We get that Elijah complex when Elijah prayed, "Oh God, I'm the only one left." God slapped him up a little bit and said, "There's 8,000 people here that haven't bowed the knee to Baal. Don't act like you're the only one." Okay, that's a little paraphrase there, but that's pretty much what happened. But see, Satan likes to convince us that we're alone. He wants to convince us that we are the only one in our family or in our school or in our neighborhood or at work. You're the only one that's going to try to be a Christian. Are you kidding? I mean, people don't do that anymore. They don't act that way. They don't talk that way anymore. Why do you want to stand out? You should fit in. Peter is writing to people just like that, saying, no, you need to stand up for your convictions. You need to stay true to what you believe in. Not just Sunday morning at church, but wherever you find yourself throughout the week. And then thirdly, Peter addresses them as strangers. Some of the translations use the word aliens. Now, by aliens, I don't mean little green people with antennas and great big eyes. That's not the kind of aliens we're talking about here. And by strangers, I don't mean what we tend to think of as just somebody we don't know. The idea is that we are substantially different. There is something unique and distinctive about us that sets us apart from other people. Have you ever been in a place where you were the only one of whatever? You're the only guy a bunch of women, or you're the only woman around a bunch of men. Maybe you're the only person of your ethnic background in that particular setting. That's the idea here. You are different. You do stand out. And Peter will refer to this idea throughout the book. He's not going to let us forget that we are living among people who are watching us. They notice that we're different. They know that there's something unique about us. They're watching our lives. We do sometimes stand out like a sore thumb. And that is something that we need to be reminded of from time to time as well. Jesus told his disciples that they were in the world, but that they were not of the world. You see, as Christians, we are aliens. We are transients. We're just temporary residents. We're travelers that are headed to our homeland. And these terms, I think, give us the key to Peter's whole letter. You see, this book is a traveler's guide for a Christian how to make it through this land until we get home. And he warns us that at times we are going to be looked down upon. We are going to be alienated because there's something strange about us. But he says that's because you have a heavenly citizenship. You're not from here. You're not going to be here forever. You're headed home. You're headed to eternity. And that's going to make a difference. In the words of William Barclay, we are the exiles of eternity. I like that. We're exiles. This is not our home. Could you imagine if somebody came by this afternoon, plucked you up, said you've got 30 seconds to come outside, and they took you halfway across the world and dropped you into a foreign country where they don't speak English. They don't eat the same kind of foods we eat. They don't wear the same kind of clothes that we wear. Everything is different. How out of place would you feel? Well, in a sense, that's the way we are spiritually. We are strangers. We are aliens. We are just temporary residents. The late Larry Norman put it this way at the end of one of his songs. What a mess this world is in. I wonder who began it. Don't ask me. I'm only visiting this planet. And that was the name of his album, Only Visiting This Planet. It's a good mindset to have. And in that same song, as it fades, he can be heard to say, this world is not my home. I'm just a passing through. Every now and then we need to remind ourselves of that. This world is not my home. We're just passing through. We're headed to a better land. We shouldn't get too comfortable here. We really are strangers, scattered throughout the world, but we're heading to a glorious new home. Now in verse 3, as I mentioned earlier, we read of a living hope that God has given to every believer. Peter brings out three truths about the Christian's hope in these opening verses. And the first is that our hope is anchored in the facts. One of my favorite verses in all the Bible is Hebrews 6:19. We have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. Several years ago, I remember I brought in a big flag. I draped it right over this piano. It's a flag of the state of Rhode Island. You think, why would you have a Rhode Island flag at Texas Church in the middle of Illinois? But the flag has a huge anchor, and underneath it, the simple word, hope. And I've always thought of that flag when I hear that verse. We have this hope as an anchor for the soul. Now, what does an anchor do? An anchor holds you in place. And when do you need an anchor? You need an anchor when it's stormy out. You need an anchor when the tide wants to pull you in and crash you against the rocks. You need that anchor that's going to hold you secure, that's going to keep you out of danger. Now, I realize this is very different from the concept of hope that the world sees. There was a newspaper man in the early part of the 20th century named H.L. Mencken. And he was very cynical, particularly when it came to religion. He referred to hope as a pathological belief in the occurrence of the impossible. Think about that. Believing something that will never happen. That's what many people view Christian faith as being. You hold fast to something that you know is never going to come to pass. That's not what the Bible speaks of as hope at all. They look at it as mental fantasy, wishing upon a star. Jesus, though, gives us hope that is grounded in the facts of what has already happened. Jesus has already won the victory. It's a bit like what happened in the War of 1812. Now, I know this is going to take you back to your American history class, which for some people might be a traumatic memory. But in the War of 1812, the United States prevailed over Britain. And the war was won. However, word had not gotten all the way down to Louisiana. And for those of you that might remember from your American history class, one of the famous battles of the War of 1812 is the Battle of New Orleans, right? And in the Battle of New Orleans, a particular general rose to prominence, which he later rode to the White House. His name was Andrew Jackson. He was known as the hero of the Battle of New Orleans. Here's the part you probably don't know or don't remember. The Battle of New Orleans was fought after the war was over. It was already decided. But news had, they didn't have CNN back then. They didn't know that yet. So they're still fighting the battle even though the war has already been decided. I think that's a great image of our lives as Christians today. Yes, we are still fighting the battle. Satan is still doing his best to fight against God and God's people. But the war has already been won. And that is the good news of Christianity. That is what our hope is anchored in. It's anchored in the fact that it's already been won. So that while we are strangers in this world, while we seem like aliens, while at times it feels like everybody is against us, in fact, the war has already been won. It just hasn't reached all the way to us yet. One day it will. We know that it will. It just hasn't happened yet. And that's why we can speak of the hope of the Christian as being something certain. It holds the future in the present because of what has been done in the past. Jesus has already conquered Satan. He has already conquered death and the grave. Our hope is realized. We know Jesus today, but because Jesus is coming again, because one day He will come back and set up His kingdom on earth, the goal of our faith is still future. So in one sense, we live in a present that is already future. One scholar calls it already but not yet. That's really where our faith lies. It's already been accomplished. We're just waiting for the fulfillment. Now another difference between the Christian's hope and the world's hope is that our hope is objective. It is anchored in the facts of what God has already revealed. And if you go to the end of that passage that we read earlier, in 1 Peter 1, verses 10 through 12, Peter talks about the prophets of old, that God had prophesied through them that Christ would come, that Christ would suffer and die and be raised again. Now, we look at that and it all makes sense. Sure. Isaiah 53 is talking about Jesus. Yes, Jonah being in the whale for 3 days and then coming out again, that's a picture of Christ being in the grave. Sure, that all makes sense. But at the time, it didn't. At the time when the prophets wrote, they didn't see it clearly. They didn't understand it all, but they wrote it down anyway. Because they knew that God was faithful. Even if they didn't understand it all, they knew He would bring it to pass. And what a great challenge for us today. When we look at our world, we may not have all the answers. We may not understand how is God going to work His will in all of the mess that we're seeing in the world today. And we don't understand it all. We don't have all the details down. That's okay. Because just like the Old Testament prophets didn't have all the answers, but they knew who they believed. So we can have that confidence and that assurance that God is going to come through. And this is crucial when we encounter difficult times, as Peter's audience was at the time that he wrote this letter. See, whenever tough times arise, our emotions are the first thing to get worked up. We feel like everything's out of control. I feel like the world's gone crazy. We need to come back to what we know. And what we know for a fact is that God is in control. What we know for a fact that even though the storms of life might be rocking our boat, we have an anchor that's holding us. And that's something we can be sure of. Now the second truth about our hope is that it is assessed in the fire. verses 6 and 7 tell us, "In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials." Peter is not pie in the sky. Peter did not say, "Come to Jesus and all your problems will go away." Because that's certainly not the case. In fact, Jesus said to his disciples, "In this world you will have persecution. It's going to happen. It's inevitable. It's inevitable when you stand out as unique among a group of people, they're going to pick on you. Just ask the poor kid in third grade that's the only one with glasses. It's going to happen. And it happens throughout our lives. But what Peter says is that even though you go through those tough times, we rejoice. Why? The tough times come so that your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may be proved genuine and may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus is revealed. You know, Peter does not try to portray the Christian life as jumping from one cloud to the next. And people that try to tell you that aren't realistic. We do have difficulties. If the world hated Christ, they're going to hate us too. And Peter is not telling us to just slap on a smile whenever we hurt. You know, he's not trying to tell us we should face the evils of our world with some kind of stoic pessimism or mere passive fatalism. But to look at these things with an affirmation that they play a positive role in our lives. As John White writes, the Christian life is meant to be triumphant rather than trouble-free. And how can you have triumph if you don't have trials? How will we ever win if there's never a foe? I like the way J.B. Phillips paraphrases these verses. "This means tremendous joy to you, even though at present you may be temporarily harassed by all kinds of trials. This is no accident. It happens to prove your faith, which is infinitely more valuable than gold. And gold, as you know, even though it is ultimately perishable, must be purified by fire." Did you catch those words? This is no accident. How many times when we run into a tough situation, when circumstances are going against us, we're like, "God, what are you doing? Why is this happening to me? There's something wrong here." Yeah, maybe not. According to this passage, We go through difficulties to strengthen our faith. I like the way Warren Wiersbe puts it. A faith that cannot be tested cannot be trusted. Think about that. A faith that cannot be tested cannot be trusted. If it is not going to survive through the difficulties, then it ain't worth much, is it? But what happens to gold when you put it under fire? Does it burn up? No. It purifies. And in fact, in the ancient world, the goldsmith would take the gold and he would heat it up, get it to where it's boiling. And as it would boil, the dirt and all the impurities would rise to the top and he could skim it off. But we're told that the goldsmith knew his job was done when he could look into that liquid gold and see his face reflected in it. What a great picture that is of our faith. When God looks into our lives and sees his son's face reflected in us, that's when our faith is purified. That's what it means to grow up into Jesus Christ, to become like him. And how's that going to happen? It's going to happen through the difficulties. But isn't it great to know that all of our difficulties are just part of that temporary world we're passing through? Think about all of the things that bothered you this last week. All the things that got you worried, got you upset, made you tense and nervous. Think about those things. How many of those things are going to matter 100 years from now? How many of those are going to matter a year from now? A month from now? Next week? We probably won't even remember those things. But oh, they're right front and center and they're our whole world. Peter is saying, let's get a perspective. let's understand that these things are working to strengthen our faith. And then finally, our hope is assured in the future. Our living hope is one that has life in it and gives life to us. You see, time destroys most hopes. You know, we have hopes that the longer they stay unfulfilled, the less likely it seems they ever will be. But our hope gets more precious and more glorious as time goes on. Kenneth Wiest writes, "Heaven is a safe deposit box where God is guarding our inheritance for us under constant surveillance." Isn't that a great, great idea? God is protecting our faith. We don't have to do it ourselves. God is keeping that, keeping it safe. Keeping it for that time in which we will be with Him. No disorder, no disease, not even death itself can weaken or threaten God's ultimate purpose for our lives and the glory that we're headed toward. You know, this last week it was revealed that Medicare and Social Security is on pace to run dry over the next several years. And I'm sure that's got a lot of folks worried. Isn't it great to know that our eternal inheritance is in far safer hands than that? Isn't it good to know that this world is not our home? We're just a passing through.